Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. We're in the second hour of a doubleheader tonight. I'm thrilled to be here with Reb McGrath. We're going to talk to him about not only his award-winning horror books, but his now suspense books with Boss McTavin. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Tonight, everyone. I'm thrilled that you're hanging around for hour number two. As I said, author Reb McGrath is with me. Several years ago, he won a Stoker Award for his horror books. He wrote under the pen name Kelly Wilde. We're going to talk about that. But right now, he's writing mystery suspense. His books are called The Boss McTavin Action Mysteries. It's a really interesting story, and it's a really interesting story about the way Reb publishes. I'm pleased to welcome to the studio Reb McGrath. Reb, welcome to Authors on the Air, and thank you for being with me tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, Pam. It's a real honor. Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Congratulations on the awards for your prior books. You wrote under a female author's name, under Kelly Wilde, and won a Stoker Award, which is the highest honor you could receive for horror. And you were named in as one of the world's most 100 most influential horror writers. Congratulations on that. Amazing. That was how long ago when you was writing horror?
Well, I started in, the first book was sold and around 1986. It was published in 1988. It was called The Suiting. And it was a two-book contract with Tor. And there is a bit of a story behind that. The pen name Kelly Wilde, the brainstorm I had was I liked the name Kelly Wilde, but I decided at the last minute as I started to approach agents to change the spelling of Kelly so that it would be kind of ambiguous so they couldn't tell for sure. And I deliberately sought out, and you got to remember back in, this was 1986 when I was pitching it, email wouldn't come along for another 10 years.
Right.
And I studiously avoided the telephone. So the game I was playing was to, nobody was to know for sure. And the agent who eventually took me on lived in Pennsylvania. So I had a well over a year little game that we had to play there where I couldn't talk over the phone with her and refused to meet with her until we actually sold the book. Turned out to be, she did think I was female. When I got off the bus in Pennsylvania, I could see her jaw just drop.
That's too funny.
Sorry, but I never said I was a female. I just engaged in a warm correspondence and let her think what she liked.
There you go. Well, it obviously worked, and you obviously were well-loved. Tor is one of my favorite publishers, by the way, and I think they still put out some of the best horror and science fiction around. I like them a lot, and I like all their publicists, so congratulations on that. So what made you decide to change and write mystery suspense? Because the Boss McTavin books are totally not horror, although in a kind of a humorous way he might be a mess. They're not horror. He's an interesting character. Why the change up?
Well, it's not as dramatic a change as you might think, Pam, because back when I sold The Suiting, I had a two-book option with Tor, and I wanted to write mystery even at that point. I never consciously set out to write with The Suiting a horror novel. It had a supernatural twist at the end, but I was committed to, with the two-book contract, I had to write a second horror novel, and I even went to the length of changing agents because I really wanted to do mystery, and the new agent that took me on landed a deal that got me some money I could definitely use, but I was committed to write two more horror novels, and by that time I was a horror writer. And when the market crashed at the end of the second book, by the time my fourth book or the second book of the two-book contract with Dell, by the time that was published in 1993, everybody was losing their book options. People were losing their agents. The horror market had really, it was just a shadow of itself at that point.
Wow.
So what I did, I pursued what I wanted to do. I just said, okay, if the I've got to get away from being seen as a horror writer, and nothing against horror, but I had always wanted to write mysteries. So I actually continued to write books that I wanted to write, even though nobody was taking them on at that point.
Interesting. What I find fascinating is the fact that you were a horror writer who wanted to write mystery, and many of the authors that I speak to who write mystery and suspense and thrillers also want to dabble in horror. They're especially noir writers. Those are they call them the neo-noirs, the new breed of noir writers. All seem to have a little bit of horror in them too. Are you surprised by that?
No, not really. Especially in the noir genre. I mean, I don't consider myself, I mean, I've heard people refer to my stuff as hard-boiled or neo-noir. I think of it as more neon noir, kind of a little bit more razzmatazz, stylish. But the horror background has definitely come into play. I mean, they have a lot of action in these things. In the first Boss McTavin book, he begins going through this unimaginably horrific experience that transforms him into the Boss McTavin character. So I've drawn on my horror background. Just
that's
some
good.
There.
So since you're now writing what you want to write, but do you ever have a desire to write maybe supernatural or to go science fiction? Are you kind of settled where you are and you're okay for right now?
Well, actually, it's a good question. I mean, I've got two streams going. In the Amazon books, readers will find that they're all under the name Red McGrath, but we have the Boss McTavin action mysteries. But there's also a series of standalone titles called the Fast and the Furies. And a couple of the titles have supernatural or science fiction elements to them. One of them, the most recent one. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. No, go ahead. Do you finish?
I was going to say the most recent one is about the ghost of Julius Caesar coming back into the present day looking for a suitable host so that he can find Cleopatra. And so I'm doing what I want to do between the mysteries on the one and the more fantasy or science fiction Fast and Furious. I can do both.
I love that story, by the way. Caesar's Ghost. I love that's. Am I saying it right? Am I giving the title correctly? I don't want to say it wrong.
Yeah.
I love that story, and you call it an M history, but mystery, and it is the
mystery.
Fifth book in this series. Yeah, it's really cute, and the story is really fun, and I know you describe that particular group of books is kind of romantic suspense, but I like them. I think they're kind of supernatural, and I like them an awful lot. They're fun, even though, you know, there's a little bit of, I think this is the one that we were talking about before. For those of you who've never seen Reb's Amazon author page, you really got to go and see what he does. It's something very different. Excuse me while I just talk about you rather than to you for a minute. I was reading, I was trying to bone up on some of the reviews and some of the stories before you and I were talking, and I noticed you do something very unusual. After you give the synopsis of your book on Amazon, you put a little bit of trivia involved there, where maybe talking about where your story idea came from or your process. But on this one, you talked about you had to know about the tactical weapons that were in the book, and so you decided to test everything, all the weapons that were mentioned, and you talked about testing the stun gun, but you didn't notice that your fingers had touched the terminals, and you shocked yourself.
Yeah.
So I love that story.
Lord.
So I was really laughing pretty hard about that, and then you said, I kind of wondered what it felt like for Caesar to have been stabbed 23 times. And you thought, well, I'll try to jab myself, not stab, but jab myself in a controlled way with a sharp tactical pen. And you said, I managed 12 jabs before I fell down, agonized and unable to continue. The experience led me to see, though, that my ghost was driven by two things, the desire to roam once more and to avoid at all costs a death like the old Caesars. I thought it was brilliant. I love reading these little pieces of trivia that you include with your story synopses. So congratulations on doing something very, very different. It's just delightful. Truly. I love it. So so let's talk now about Seattle Red, which is book number 4 in Boss McTavish. But first, before we do that, would you tell listeners a little bit about who Boss is and how he came into being? Because he's quite a character.
He is, and he evolves over the course of the books. They are standalone, but in Southern Scotch, he actually begins. He was originally born in Glasgow, and he is, or Edinburgh, rather, then raised in Cleveland. He was a great, great athlete at one point, but his career torpedoed after a divorce, and he ends up crashing in Atlanta. One night, he ends up in the wrong place at the wrong time and is mistaken for somebody else, and they do all but kill him at that point. He's half-blinded, partially maimed. He returns. I've always loved stories like this, from the Count of Monte Cristo down the line of people who return after a period of years as a different form of themselves. So Pete McGregor has left the building. He returns as the tall, rail-thin Boss McTavish, head of Boss Corrections. And he's wealthy and powerful at this time, on the trail of the men who beat him. And over the course of the 4 books, I've tried to take him from being kind of a comical, almost a, I wouldn't call him a Mike Hammer type character, but he has some of Mike Hammer's brutality in the first book. But I wanted him to evolve over the course of the books into his present form. And Seattle Red, he's extremely wealthy at this point. He takes only the what he calls the corrections that interest him. Sometimes he will work for pro bono cases or reduce his fee, but he's elegant, he's tough, he's hard-boiled, and yet it's also based, I would also say, the original inspiration was the old Have Gun, Will Travel Western series on TV. But I wanted to do a completely original spin on that. He doesn't dress in black, doesn't ride a horse, obviously. He does have a distinctive card. And I've also shown how he can grow from somebody who only reads Pulp Fiction into a classics quoting Boss in the 4th book. He is, as you said, he's a character, and I think he is compelling.
He's a really interesting guy. Is there a nexus where we hear about how he made his wealth and how he came from humble beginnings to become this wealthy man? Or have we to yet hear that story?
He gives a intimations of it in the first book when he's talking. He has actually caught the guy who accidentally put him in the position where he took the beating. And he tells him that he made the money partly from insurance. He had gone to collect some money that belonged to the company he worked for, a very, very small amount. But because he was mistaken for somebody else, he, as I say, he almost died. He made about a couple of $1 million off the insurance on that. And his for his corrections, he's made everything from $100,000 to he's worked pro bono, and he's made, in one case, the Alcatraz correction, he made a couple more million off that. So, yes,
so
he's invested. He owns a...
Go ahead. I have a question, though, when you
finish
that thought.
Owner. Yeah, he's part owner in a hotel, so he has business investments going as well.
So I want you to explain what a correction is to those who are not familiar with how you're using the term, because it's really important to the series to understand exactly what a McTavish correction is, the Alcatraz correction and things like that. Will you explain it?
Yes. Boss is very, after the first book, where he was originally setting out for revenge, and his concept of what a correction is evolves, by the second book, The Alcatraz Correction, it's very solid, and he makes very clear that he won't take any case strictly for revenge. He has to believe in what's being done. it has to correct this in the case of the Alcatraz correction. I don't want to give away the entire story, but he, without taking direct revenge, restores the dignity and the legend of the men who originally escaped from Alcatraz. And the correction includes like setting up a monument for them on the island itself. But this goes beyond, as I say, revenge. It's balancing something that is totally out of balance in his eyes.
Okay, so he's almost righting a wrong, or he's an avenger in certain ways, not a revenger, but an avenger in certain cases. Would that be a correct statement?
That would be correct, yes. And I think it reaches its epitome. I think it reaches that in Seattle Red, I think, is the most complex correction that he does.
How did you come up with Boss? Where did this character come from?
That was, I mean, the name?
There's the character.
Or the character.
Mm-hmm.
It came from my fascination with the Have Gun Will Travel series and my refusal to rip it off. I had seen so many series. I mean, I had drawn up a chart at one point from Travis McGee to Spencer and others down the line that had taken what I regarded as the surface gimmicks that, with the exception of Spencer, I felt the others had fallen short. Spencer was original. It was a good twist. But I wanted to go further, and I've always been – I had this idea in my head, a combination. I love Scottish culture. And I had a feeling for the Deep South, and I just started envisioning what, you know, the two of them fused, the Southern Scotch, in one man. And Boss grew out of that obsession.
In the first book, your title of your synopsis is Boogie Nights Meets Have Gun Will Travel. And so I'm trying to envision that because I remember Boogie Nights and I remember Have Gun Will Travel. Barely, you know, I don't want to date myself, but I remember. So I'm trying to figure out the Boogie Nights part of it because, and I'm sure it's there, but I don't want you to give too much away either. You also talk about.
Well, I think we can say.
Oh, you can safely say, go ahead then.
I think we can safely say without giving too much away that the vengeance trail that he has in mind at the beginning of the story leads him back to Atlanta and a confrontation with the adult film industry there. That's where Boogie Nights came in.
Okay. I didn't know if you wanted to say or not, so that makes sense to me now. It's really interesting in your trivia that you even discuss your character's accent. You say it's a defiant blend of Southern Scotch, a cross between the Butler boys, you know, Gerard and Rhett. So I thought that was really interesting. So Rhett Butler and Gerard Butler, who is an actor, a Scottish actor. I think he's Scottish anyway. I don't see that many. You know, I don't have a television, Reb. You and I have talked about that. And I don't get out to see very many movies, and it wouldn't be a Gerard Butler movie. I'd have to go see something like Suicide Squad or Star Wars. But anyway, so I like how you describe it, and give me a visual of what Boss looks like now. If you were casting him in a movie, who would he be? In your mind's eye, who do you envision as playing the role?
Well, if I know that writers don't have very much say in this, but I've always, from the start, I had a reaction in mind against the 6'4" heroes who weigh like 225 pounds or more.
Yeah.
That it wasn't what I wanted to do. I envisioned a rail thin man of 6'1" who weighs. He's often mistaken for skinny because he tends to wear very loose clothing, and he has what he regards as a blendable physique. So he's 6'1", weighs a little over 160 pounds, without being skinny. It's just he's a workaholic.
Wow.
He has a spiky, mostly blonde, some gray hair, but it's spiky. He's a Rod in the first book. He's a Rod Stewart fanatic. That's about the only music he listens to. And he has a very bushy kind of early Burt Reynolds or Tom Selleck type mustache. So it's thick. That's one of his trademarks, and the eye patch. Who would I see? He would be almost ideal if he were willing to lose some weight because he's too bulked up, but Gerard Butler would be good.
Interesting. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Not at all who I would envision, but you know, that's the writer's prerogative, I suppose. Talk to me about the Reb growing up and your day to day. Tell me something about yourself. Tell me who you are and tell listeners, you know, tell us about Reb the Writer.
Well, Reb the Writer. I mean, I was born in Buffalo, but at that time after college, the formative experiences for me were, I mean, I always wanted to be a writer, and I had a terror of getting married and having children and leading a conventional life, and I was afraid that my writing passion would be taken from me. I ended up going to Canada for a number of reasons and was there for 10 years. This was at the time of the Vietnam War, but my reason for going, I was devastated when Bobby Kennedy was shot. It's like,
right.
I can't explain it. It was the night that he was shot, when he was winning in California, I had a flash that if he won the primary, that he was going to be dead. And I woke up the next morning and he'd been shot.
Oh my God.
I said, how can I live in a country where I can predict when a hero is going to die? And I went up to Canada for 10 years. That was my formative experience, being in exile. I was actually a man without a country. I had renounced my citizenship. I was stateless for 10 years. I had, and then when I changed my mind, when I realized what I had done, I went to the embassy and just collapsed. I was in tears. I said, I've messed up. Luckily, when I had renounced my citizenship, I said, if it ever turns out that I'm doing this for personal reasons, not political, I said, if I ever realize that I've made a mistake, and the American ambassador up there said, well, it might be possible, but it won't be easy. I had a 2-year legal fight to get back to the country, and I came back as a stateless person, as an immigrant. I had a green card. It took 5 more years to get my citizenship. So at that point, I had been stateless for 15 years. That was at the heart of my experience, and that's figured into every book that I've written, being a stranger in a strange land.
Wow.
I bet you haven't heard that one before, have you?
No, I've never heard that before. I'm stunned by it all. And now, of course, you know, you do that and you never come back. It's kind of crazy. You told me when we were talking before the show, you had a story about Walgreens, and I'll tell you what I remember, because I read your blogs. You have a couple of them, but I was reading one of your blogs about, you posted an interesting story about someplace in Haight-Ashbury, a Walgreens there in a particular corner where they actually locked down the toothpaste, and then you guided your readers to a newspaper article about the 8 things that are stolen most often in that particular Walgreens, and one of them was toothpaste. And you said you had a bunch of interesting stories about Walgreens. Will you tell me a couple of them, please?
Yeah, because, you know, readers often, total strangers, wonder where we get our ideas from, and this book evolved. I had worked in 2 Walgreens in 2 different cities in Charlotte, North Carolina. I worked the graveyard shift for 6 years to give me time, a schedule that allowed me to write. Then I moved to Seattle, and it wasn't Haight-Ashbury. It was actually in Seattle, the corner of 3rd and Pike was the turning point, because here, I mean, I had seen a fair amount of theft in Charlotte, but it was the graveyard shift. So it wasn't a frenzied stream. It was people coming in throughout the night and stealing, and we couldn't do anything. But at 3rd and Pike, I was there watching guys come into the store and walk out of the store with their arms loaded. And because of the rules, nobody could stop them.
But who would want to stop them, though, Reb? Who would want to stop them? I would be afraid.
Well, you'd have good reason to be afraid, because these are not just shoplifters. I started tuning in, talking to the police, doing some investigation, and learned about organized retail crime. These are professionals. They're making a living at it. They're walking out. They know they can't be stopped. They're fencing this, and they're making a good living at it. But you mentioned the 8 thing. The things that are stolen the most are not only the electric toothbrushes. Excuse me, but Tide is the absolute biggest theft item.
Tide?
White gold. Tide, baby formula are the big items. You can't
Holy
keep
moly.
them out. You can't keep them even locked down. They'll break the locks to get it because this stuff is easily sold. Everybody needs it. And that led to Seattle Red. I said, God, what nerve it takes to get this. I mean, thieves coming in, punching managers in the face, knocking them down. I said, I got it right about this.
It's just bizarre to me that, well, you know, I don't live in a high crime area. And so I guess, you know, that's it. And I mean, it would seem to me that after a while, a store would say, you know, we're losing too many managers and too much merchandise. It's just not going to work. But that's just me, you know, my fear of being a victim of something like that. Somebody ever came into a business where I was working and they wanted it, I'd say, let me help you to the car. I don't know. You know, I don't want to take it. It's not mine. You can have it. I'm not putting my life on the line for it. But I did not realize that it was like that. I worked one time in a Staples store, like over the holidays or something, and it was interesting because as I was in that cycle there, what they call temporary holiday help, I actually was working when it was back to school, and Staples, like many other stores, had a special day for teachers. You came in and showed your teacher ID, you got an extra discount, whatever, because so many teachers are buying supplies for their classrooms. The day after, however, was a swarm of people returning items that you'd never seen before. And I guess when you have that many people in a store, there's no such thing as security. You know, they take anything that's not nailed down, from 59-cent pens to a box of paper clips. It's crazy. So, but that was always funny for me when people would come back with stuff I'd never seen before, you know, and say, oh, I've lost the receipt, or I'm returning it for my mom. It's nutty, but and I have seen people take racks of clothing out of store. I used to live in Miami, so that was pretty common. But the way you describe it, it was kind of funny reading the story. But I guess really it's not. Retail theft costs us a lot of money, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and you know they call it a victimless crime, but the consumer is the ultimate victim because the store, they're getting it back. They have the insurance. Their premiums are going to be raised, of course, so they in turn are going to raise their prices to cover it. And my hat goes off to the few stores I've seen in town where that will aggressively pursue thieves, sometimes almost to the ridiculous. What might seem like a ridiculous extreme. I saw a guy screaming. There's one store that's notorious in town. It's a Crest Supermarket. They will go after anybody for anything, and they're sending a message, don't steal. They handcuffed a guy, chased to a block, and handcuffed him for stealing a donut.
Jeez. Well, I you know, and just probably to be kicked from any type of court, I'm sure. But probably that guy didn't want to go back in the store again, so in a way I guess it worked. Is it true that you're a former journalist, a syndicated journalist?
Yeah, that was one of the big turning points in my life. And I remember I was up in Canada struggling to make it as a writer for the 10 years I was up there. My luck really turned in the right towards the end of my stay, I believe it was in the eighth year. I had been doing book reviews, and I started doing personality profiles. Eventually, I sold a syndicated column. I mean, it was published in every major Canadian paper. And I was really starting to make it when I was accepted back into the country, and I had to put all of that behind me and start over again.
What kind of journalism did you do, Reb?
It was freelance journalism. So I say I was doing personality profiles.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm thinking you're writing for a newspaper doing hard crime stories and things like that. Interesting. Was it newspaper work?
Freelance.
Was it magazines? Was it anyone who was interested
newspaper.
In the story? Newspaper.
Basically, my major work was for I wrote for both the Toronto Star and the Toronto Sun.
Wow.
So
it was
enjoyable.
Many authors.
It was a tough decision.
But so many
authors what?
Coming. So many authors coming from journalism. And I think that one of the things that comes out of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but because you have to do the five W's and the H, you know, which I was a journalism major myself, I remember. Does that teach you to write a tighter story when you're writing fiction?
Oh, I think so. I think so. That, a combination of that, and I also did retail direct mail for a number of years for Macy's, the Emporium Capital, Macy's in New York. And we could, because it was direct mail, we had to come to the point within a sentence or two. I mean, it was, you had to be there. I mean, you had to be fast, get in and get out. So, yeah, this had a definite effect on the fact that I'm writing very short fiction compared to most novelists out there. I think the average length, 60 to 80,000 words for most novels, and I'm doing for the Fast and Furious, they're around 40. The Boss McTavern series is around 45. It's just, I don't like any flab on my books. I want them to move like the wind.
When you are writing your story, are you peeling the layers of Boss away a little bit more each time? And if you are, do you know what's coming up next already? Do you have a fully fleshed out character in your mind, or are you discovering him as your readers are?
Well, I'm discovering that I think there's a pretty clear, in many ways, a clear character arc that Boss is traveling from the Mike Hammer type thug, a comical Mike Hammer type thug and Southern Scotch, to the more elegant Boss who's about to be married in the fourth book, and his fiance is having a definite effect on him. He's definitely evolving as a character, but I don't want it to get to the point where readers can't jump in at any point in the series and not be able to follow it. So it's subtle, but it's clear, the progression. And I think after the fifth book, which I've already started on right now, I think Boss is going to level off as far as his character at that point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What inspires you for your stories? I know you told me that the first one, the Walgreens story, was what happened. Do you see something, read something, hear something, or just dream it up? And you say, I think I'm going to do a what if right here, and that's how it happens?
Well, the best answer I have to that is that it always clicks for me when there's a combination of an idea that interests me, like in my head, let's say the theft angle. I mean, it's something I've been interested in for a long time, having had my pocket picked and had various professional thefts of my work in one way or another I've experienced. So I have a feeling for that, but I also need the emotional core before I can start to work. And nothing clicked for me on Seattle Red until I actually witnessed the violence in that store, in that area of Third and Pike. Once I started to feel how scary it was, like seeing people coming into the store having been hit in the head with hammers, women who had been raped coming in screaming for mercy, how could I not write about it?
Oh my God,
it's a rough,
it sounds horrible.
It's a rough.
Yeah,
I love Seattle, but I don't like Third and Pike.
I bet not. I bet not. But you observe that.
There's a second part to your question that I can answer very quickly. The suiting.
Okay.
Going back to the first book, I was interested. I mean, I had all the emotional stuff was there. The feeling of alienation and exile. But nothing clicked until one day I actually found a suit in a subway locker. I returned it. But then I began to think, what if I had kept it? Well, that's interesting. But what if I kept it and it didn't fit? It was too big. And I felt compelled to grow until I could fill the suit. That's how that one came about.
That's bizarre. Writers' minds are so strange, I have to tell you. You guys just, you know, I had an author on before you at 7 o'clock who started off in seminary and ended up writing erotica. You guys just, you connect the dots in such a roundabout way. There's no linear thinking as far as I'm concerned. So that's why I love writers so much, because it's always different. And how you come up with storylines is amazing to me. You mentioned that you're working on Boss 5. How long does it take you to get a book to where you're – I know that you are a copious editor of your own work. Over and over and over again, you're refining your work a lot. I remember during this book, you and I would talk occasionally, and you would say, I'm going through edits again. I'm doing edits again. I'm really winnowing everything out there. So I know the editing process takes you a while, but what about the actual writing process? How long does that take you?
Well, I've gone through a major change on that. Things are, I'm actually picking up for me a little bit of speed. Let me just say what I used to do, and I think the reason it used to take me years to do my books was that I would work in basically thirds. I would write a third, then I would go back and rewrite it over and over and over again. When I got it to a stage where I liked it, I would tackle the next part. And I think that was exhausting me going like that. What I've started doing now, I really get the first draft done in about 3 months. And after that, it's going to take me at least 6 months to go through the 6 to 9 months to go through the revision process.
Wow. That's amazing.
3 months to draft and about 9 months to rewrite. Yeah.
I'm not one of the speedy ones. Do you storyboard, Rex?
Like what?
Do you outline or storyboard, or are you just kind of flying by the seat of your pants?
I've only done one book without an outline, and that was Caesar's Ghost, which actually came out pretty well, I think. But basically, yes, I outline. I'm a compulsive outliner, and I'm part of a dying breed in that way. I think more and more writers are not rewriting, or outlining rather, but yes, I do.
So your essential first draft is you kind of throwing the words on a page from your outline, and then you fine-tune it over and over and over again. You are obsessive about your edits, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely.
How different is your story from outline to final version?
Well, I can give you the numbers will tell a story there. The first draft is almost always twice as long as the final version is going to be. And
wow.
The second draft is just a nightmare for me. I mean, it's like digging a ditch. It's backbreaking work. But by the time I get to a third draft, I'm actually able to see what the promise in the book, and I begin to take heart and to really go at it then. But the first draft is pretty horrendous.
Is it the same book that you had in your mind and that you outlined, or has the book changed substantially after your revisions?
No, I'll tell you what I realized. Other writers might be able to do their pruning in their heads before, as they do the first draft, but I've discovered that what works for me, the method that I enjoy the most is, I call it making mud pies. Some people call it the vomit phase, but I just have learned not to restrict myself. I let myself go wild, just throw everything in, including the kitchen sink, because a whole page might be filled with nothing but gibberish, and then suddenly I can see a little flash of magic, and I don't think I'd get that if I was playing the editor too soon.
Interesting.
That makes sense?
Interesting. It does. Yeah, you kind of throw it against the wall to see what sticks, and what sticks might be just the gem you're looking for. So it makes sense to me a lot. Does the book always turn out the way you want it to, or is it the same story that you want it to be?
Yes and no. Let me clarify one thing. As I said, I'm a compulsive outliner, but I almost never look at the outline after I finish. It's like it was enough for me to get it down there. I have a very clear sense of the way things are going. The story goes pretty much the way I thought it would go, but surprises abound. I mean, someone I thought was going to be a minor character might turn out to be major. That's happened to me several times. Surprises are there. So I don't have it all figured out in my head by any means, even with the outline.
Is that part of the fun of writing?
Oh, the process of discovery?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, yes. I love the surprises. It takes a certain amount of courage there. Sometimes I have to really screw up my courage. It's like, hey, the muse is trying to tell you something. Lose your control instincts here. Let's run with this and see what happens. So I'm willing to make I don't think there are any mistakes. Just go with it. Take away what doesn't work. Try it again. Get rid of this negative thinking. It's like I'm no good because I made a mistake. We have to, all writers have to get past that idea. There are no mistakes.
Sure.
There are just things that work and some that don't. I think.
Well, it's in draft form anyway. It's not like you're publishing, you're hit publish on the stuff that's not good. So you're right. You do kind of have to throw it all in there. Out of the mist and the fog, you might just get this fabulous thing that comes up over the horizon for yourself. So good on you. I think that's great. You told me what the joy of writing is. What's the downside of writing?
Well, my answer is going to be tempered by the fact that I'm a writer who also works. I mean, I have a job, so I have to be the amount of discipline and the amount of loneliness that we're willing to experience and to put up with and to transcend in the writing of a book is extreme. If I tried to have a normal or a regular life while I was writing a book, it would take me 3 or 4 years to write each book, and I'm past the age where I can afford to take that amount of time. I'm going to finish these books, if possible, in 15 months or 15 to 18 maximum. And that means a lot of nights alone. I mean, I have an extremely strict schedule. I get up at 4:30 in the morning so that I can have a couple hours to write before I go to work, and then I'll take another hour and a half after I finish work. So it's kind of like jump into bed and bound out of bed to write is what I do until the book is done.
Wow. Wow. Wow, you're very, very, very
I better get a cat. I better get a cat soon, Pam.
You better, Reb. You really better. You know, you've been writing for a while now, and you've written in a lot of different ways. You've written in a lot of different genres, from copy to bios and journalism and horror and romantic suspense, and now your mysteries, your action mysteries, which I love. What do you take away from all the different writing, and what do you give to new writers?
Wait, I'm going to make sure I understand your question. What do I take away from writing?
From all the different genres, what have you learned that you're willing to go ahead and share with somebody who's just starting off?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's a good question because I just finished writing a blog called, we tend to say, I've heard this so many times, it's my way or the highway. And rewrote that as a naked byway, byway or the highway. And what I mean by that is that I think even writers and readers, we tend to go at books from our own perspective. Now, for a writer, it's only natural to be thinking, oh, gosh, I do it this way. This pace is kind of slow here. I mean, the sentences are a little longer than I like. The paragraphs are too extensive. But I think we have to get past that and just say, okay, this is not my book. I didn't write this book. What is the writer trying to accomplish? Has he met his goals? And am I big enough? Is my mind expansive enough to enjoy this book? And reading has become, since I took this approach, much more enjoyable. I mean, I can read books that I normally wouldn't read in genres. I don't read a lot of science fiction, but I'm reading that now. I have very little feeling for historical novels, but I've read a couple, and I've loved them. So I hope writers and readers can both do that. It's like, hey, this is not my book. Let me try to get into the book that the author is trying to write. And writers, by the same token, should not try to read their readers' minds either. It's like, give the best value you can and just hope for the best.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being my guest, Reb. It's been a lovely conversation with you, and I wish you all success with Seattle Red and with the rest of your books, and I'm sure you and I are going to talk again soon. Tell everyone where they can find you on the webs, please.
Best thing to find me is if you go to the Amazon and look under Reb McGrath, and that's MacRath. My author's page will give you my the blog, and I can repeat that for you. You can also, and it'll also give you it'll tell you where my books are. The blog is Reb McGrath as one word at Blogspot, blogspot.com.
It's a lot of fun.
I try to put out one.
Way.
Yeah, instead of daily posts, I try to do one that's meaningful a week, and that way readers can keep up with it without being flooded. I hope the readers will check it out.
So do I. And you're on Facebook, and I hope you go get a cat too.
I intend to as soon as I can. Thanks, Pam.
There you go. Thank you so much for being with you, Reb. Will you promise to come back sometime soon?
I sure will. Thanks and good night to everybody.
Thank you so much. All right. Thanks, Reb.
All right,
have a good night. Bye.
You too.
And that's my show for tonight, folks. I hope you join me on Friday. I have two authors on Friday again. Mark Greeney, who I met this weekend at Southwest Readers Fest, and James Latoile, who's also a noir crime fiction writer. It's going to be lots of fun. Thank you for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, all.